obviously deadly. 50 million lives lost in World War II, but it took the work of vast armies to do that. Now, because of modern technology, it's a whole different ballgame, and you can have deadly capability and not even represent a state now, but just a group of terrorists living hidden in a society someplace, in Europe or someplace else, and basically friendly to the United States, that nonetheless has evil intentions and is prepared to kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. So it's a different scale of threat in some respects. On the other hand, the consequences to modern society, what the damage that could be done to our economy, needless to say, those things are every bit as dangerous, I think, as the situations we faced in the past. It used to be we could retire behind our oceans and be fairly confident that we were safe and secure. That day's gone. We know in the aftermath of 9/11 that you know, what's going on in the remote mountains of Afghanistan can ultimately lead to the deaths of thousands of Americans here at home.
My last thought here is, with that reality, are you as surprised as I am the country is so divided? We're even debating the Patriot Act, even debating NSA surveillance, you know, even debating securing the borders in some respects. Is that somewhat shocking in light of the nature of the threat you're describing?
I think it is. Of course, I have my view, and people say, well, that's just change. That's the best way to do it.
Modern technology, you can have deadly capabilities that are not represented by a state. Well, Mr. Great Pigeon Hunter Cheney, Al-Qaeda and other clowns like them do represent a state. Sam's military intelligence false flag operational shadow state. Then you say people sitting around in places like Europe are ready to kill thousands. You mean like in the U.S. Pentagon, where programs like the Northwood documents were hatched? And what really did happen on 9/11? Well, never mind. And then Hannity, you clown, are yapping about, are you surprised that the country is divided and is even debating NSI surveillance in the Patriot Act? Well, Hannity, when people can be and have been whisked away with no due process, rendered like cattle, to be cattle prawed to some of Sam's barbaric ally friends and regimes, I think when there's no real surveillance by the likes of you at Fox News, it would cause some people to have some concern about the oppression issue going on. But hey, this is just an ungrateful slave in revolt. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. You're listening to 103.3 freakradio.org, 101.1 with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1 Berkeley, 96.3, 107.5 Antelope Valley. Check out propagandapress.org, savagejustice.blogspot.com, radioforall.net. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to deal with more propaganda. From Hollywood to the industrial market complex estate. Yeah, all that and hell a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Pension seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets in the solar system.
The role of Hollywood and the corporate media is tied to the interests of the market elite of the U.S. empire. The globalization of the American idea is tied in the role of Hollywood's worldview, which of course is linked with the business media and into the state's interest. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called The Hollywood Corporate Media Military Industrial Market Complex Estate, we'll address some of these issues at hand. First off, let's get jumping into a dialogue with Dave Robb, an investigator, researcher on Hollywood war movies. And let's have him outline a TV show back in the day that was called Lassie, and the role and influence that the military had on a particular episode.
I was a reporter at the Hollywood Trade Papers for 20 years. I was the labor, legal, and investigative reporter, and I was interested in organized crime and discrimination against minorities, the blacklist, a lot of things. But this was always something I was interested in, because I'd always heard that filmmakers who want military assistance have to give their scripts, and I thought, well, gee, I wonder if there's any paperwork on this. So I started looking into it, and I found that there are tens of thousands of pages of documents, the correspondence between the producers, internal memos written by the military, and I love documents, and this is a book and a story that really can only be told with the documents. So I just became obsessed with the documents, and the documents are really startling. This is a TV show from the 1950s, a very popular TV show in America called Lassie, about a little boy and his dog. They did several shows that had to do with the military, and the military had all kinds of suggested changes in the stories. There was an episode called Timmy versus the Martians. The little boy thinks he's contacted Martians, and there was a plane crash. In the original story, the Army came out and did a test and picked up all the pieces of the crashed airplane, and they took it to the wind tunnel and tested it, and they determined that the reason Lassie howled was because she heard a high-pitched vibration in the wing. There was a malfunction in the design of the airplane. And that Lassie had now saved the day because of Lassie howling. They knew what the problem was, and now they could fix all the airplanes so this wouldn't happen again. But when they asked the military for assistance, all they wanted was some standard footage of a Cessna airplane, reconnaissance military aircraft. They said, no, we won't help you unless you change the script to make it so that the airplane was not faulty. There's no problem with the aircraft. So this is, these are their notes right here. These are the military notes to the producers of Lassie. We have also reviewed the Timmy versus the Martians. We have reviewed the script and interposed no objections except that we strongly recommend that you change the circumstances of the airplane crash. They don't want children to get the idea that the military makes faulty equipment, because children of those are the main targets of their recruiting efforts, because they make children like the Army, like the military, like everything about the military, and so when they grow up, they'll want to join the military. Over and over, the documents are full of statements where they are targeting children to be future recruits. And the children and the people who see these films don't know that this is an advertisement for the military. The military generally allow themselves to be involved with Hollywood because they're already spending tens of millions of dollars every year on making promotional commercials to try and get recruits. On the other hand, we in Hollywood just want to, you know, make a bigger and better movie, giving the audience more bang for their buck. So it's not hard to see what we're trying to get out of it.
So you can see the obviously conflicting dynamics taking place, at least for the masses, not conflicting within the military security state and establishment that is intentionally trying to indoctrinate the masses with propaganda. So here, this was some TV show back in the 50s. So this was over 50 years ago. They were playing this game steadily out. And one little TV show, they were willing to strongly advise the changing, which ended up happening in the particular program where it looked like the reason for the plane crashing was because of a military defect. Now, we know all about the Scud missiles and all this type of stuff showing the calamity of believing in U.S. military integrity, justice, or even quality craftsmanship, as many G.I. Joes and Janes are finding out as their Humvees are being blown to bits by all kinds of devices, some that were not even all of that technically advanced. But in the world of how the Hollywood mechanism works out, how War Hollywood plays itself out, these truths, these facts are to be reconstructed in another lens and play into the propaganda that is deeply part of the American experiment. What's also fascinating is they also portray the various figures in this kind of noble way. The noble warrior for the state. The state can do no wrong. It's pure. At the same time, you have like an article that came out July 13, 2007 in The Hill by Elaine Shore and Roxana Tyron called Ex-Convicts and Addicts May Get DOD Clearance. It goes like this, quote, at the Pentagon's request, Senate defense authorizers tucked deep within a defense bill a repeal of the department's restrictions on granting security clearances to ex-convicts, drug addicts, and the mentally incompetent. Well, hey, that helps out Boy George right there, but what? Anyway, the repeal provision now is creating discord between the Senate Armed Services and the Intelligence Committees. It is marked up of the 2008 Defense Authorization Bill, the Intelligence Panel voted to delete the Armed Service provision. The fate of the provision could become a flashpoint this week at the Senate as the Senate takes up the bill. The Senate Armed Service Panel seeks to repeal a 7-year-old law that established mandatory standards disqualifying certain people from receiving security clearances. Under the law, members of the military services employees of the Department of Defense or contractors working for the Pentagon cannot receive a security clearance if they have been convicted of a crime in any U.S. court and went to prison for at least 1 year. If they are unlawful users of illegal substances, if they are considered mentally incompetent, or if they have dishonorably discharged or dismissed from the armed forces. According to the Senate Armed Services Committee report, the Department of Defense requested the provision repeal because the mandatory standards, quote, unduly limit the ability of the department to manage its security clearance program and may create unwarranted hardship for individuals who have rehabilitated themselves as productive and trustworthy citizens, unquote. The law negatively affects individuals who have committed a qualifying crime but have determined trustworthy by, quote, national adjudicative standards, unquote, according to a Pentagon spokesman. Let me stop right there. So basically, they know they got all kinds of criminals. Even the criminals who don't have to serve prison time, because for white elite males in power, like Boy George and Scooty Libby, they have their own version of a no snitch law, where basically Boy George whispers in Scooter Libby's ear, don't snitch, I'll commute your sentence. Now, I know it's not looked at it like that, but that's essentially what it was. But see, condemnation only comes down for, black folks who have no snitch policies concerning the war on drugs and other things in their communities. But moving on, here, Rob goes into what gets the military corporation versus ones that do not cooperate with the military corporate complex. Funding and aid by the military when they're doing their particular movies.
These are just a handful of films that went through the Pentagon approval process. This is Behind Enemy Lines, Full Cooperation, G.I. Jane, No Cooperation, Full Metal Jacket, which showed soldiers killing, Marines killing other Marines, No Cooperation, 13 Days, No Cooperation, Top Gun, great film for the Navy, Full Cooperation, Platoon, No Cooperation, the military hated that movie, Three Kings, of course, showing soldiers stealing gold from the Iraqis, No Cooperation, Patton, of course, they love this picture, Full Cooperation, Pearl Harbor, again, Full Cooperation. Perhaps the worst thing about the collaboration between Hollywood and the military is not the censorship that goes into the films, but the self-censorship. When you know that you're going to need the military's assistance, and you know that they're going to be looking at your script, you write it to make them happy right from the beginning.
I mean, it is so terrible that you don't really have to know much history to recognize it's absurd. I mean, some people who don't know anything will think it's history, and this is part of the problem, because if it was called Tennessee, which was the working title, then it's a fictional story, it's a love story, and Michael Bay said he was making a love story as long as Pearl Harbor wasn't too far in the background because he loved to blow up ships. But if you're going to call Pearl Harbor, then there's a presumption that this is about Pearl Harbor.
One of the aspects that, develops this type of relationship is the continuous aspect of the U.S. empire being engaged in a continuous imperial expansion of war and conquest. And that, in turn, tightens up the state apparatus. You know, in 1941, Hollywood joined the war effort that was inflaming the planet at the time. And by 1943, 26,000 film industry persons and personnel served under Sam's regime. You've had artists, technicians, various individuals, writers, all part of the war propaganda effort. And this type of stuff has only accumulated and intensified as time has gone on. And when it comes to certain types of movies, if you make like a little fluff propaganda movie like Top Gun, then you'll get top billing and support for and from the military in making the film, being able to use their carrier aircraft, their airplanes, you know, all of that type of stuff. And what that does is also play into the whole spectacle stuff that is so endemic in America's cinema world, where it's the bang and the boom, as opposed to, in many instances, storytelling and good solid writing, because the narrative is often intermixed within the type of bombastic, violent spectacle that one sees on the theater screens. And this also goes through a lens by the military establishment of who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. So it all helps culminate and limit real storytelling and real historical facts about particular events and wars that the U.S. Empire has engaged in. So while this mechanism of dissent is going on, here's George C. Scott, actor, playing his part as the Imperial General in the movie Patton.
I want you to remember that no bastard ever won war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country. And then all this stuff you heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, big league ball player, the toughest boxer. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans.
So once again, you can see how this propaganda helps neuter the real aspects of how horrible wars are. Because in reality, most Americans don't experience and have not experienced real war. And they certainly have not experienced, living Americans, war within the particular home front. So when you have propaganda like this Patton movie propaganda by Scott, blathering out these cliches. It fits within the mold of how the Empire wants the masses to view these issues. So Scott says no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. You win it by making the other bastard die. Well, in reality, while all of this dying is going on, it's not done. The dying is not by the rulers. Because the rulers on all sides are looking on and playing the masses who are doing the real dying, like chess pieces on a grand chessboard. But Scott goes on, all real Americans love the sting of battle. And then he mixes it in, you know, like with big league ball players, you know, who's the fastest and all of that. So he's connecting competition to imperial murder, like it's just a game. Like it's just a video game. But this is the way you propagandize people through War Hollywood. Then he went into the propaganda about how America never lost a war and never will, because the mere thought of it is hateful. In reality, each war the masses in America and beyond, but in America, are engaged in, it's a loss for the masses of people within America and for humanity on certain levels, because it's the rulers' imperial crusade that these things are transfixed upon. It's not a war against the rulers itself. It's the masses being puppets to the rulers to engage into these imperial wars. This is why they don't care about y'all who are sitting up there in these little hospitals with a half your head blown off and missing both your arms, with 80% of your body, your skin burnt off. They don't care, because you G.I. Joes and Janes are disposable commodities for a larger agenda that they have. So you're an expectable and accepted collateral damage commodity with an American flag stamped on your head. But this is the way, in part, how this propaganda is spread out. And throughout these types of Hollywood-ish movies, there's real no defining and dissecting how these wars are perpetuated. Whose interests do they serve? The connection, in the case of World War II, between banking industrialists, energy resource capitalists, and Adolf and company, or connections between IBM and the Holocaust, or Henry Ford and Adolf. That's all relegated to textbooks or historical books and intellectual circles, but not War Hollywood. Now, we see how this Patton-type rhetoric is played out in Hollywood. And in many ways, it becomes part of the corporate war media establishment, and those who publish books, those who consider themselves respectable authors within the confines of the orthodoxy share a similar pattern of rhetoric. But when some of these clowns are easily challenged by, in this case, like Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report, it falls, well, here for yourself. As Dinesh D'Souza, author of the book The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11, let's see how a simple conversation played out between this so-called intellectual author and Stephen Colbert on Colbert's show.
My guest tonight says that to win the war on terror, we must export traditional American values. First, we have to find a way to make apple pies explode. Please welcome Dinesh D'Souza. Thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
This book is a revelation to me. Okay, it's called The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11.
Okay, I've been trying to figure this one out for a while. Walk me through it.
How did the liberals plan 9/11?
Go.
Well, first of all, the liberals convinced Jimmy Carter to withdraw American support for a valuable ally, the Shah of Iran. The United States pulled the Persian rug out from under the Shah, and who did we get? Khomeini. In trying to get rid of the bad guy, we got the worst guy.
But Reagan got back at those bastards by selling them those Hawk missiles in the 80s, right?
And
he showed them a thing or two about American muscle by giving them some.
Well, he also sent some, missiles the way of Gaddafi, which put him out of the terrorism trade. Here's the second point. In the 1990s, the radical Muslims launched a bunch of attacks. Khobar Towers, the embassies, the USS Cole. President Clinton did absolutely nothing, and bin Laden said, you know what? The United States is a bunch of cowards. And that's why he says he was emboldened to strike at 9/11.
But is all the responsibility Carter and Clinton's? Doesn't some of it lie at FDR's doorstep?
Doesn't things like
he did give away
Social Security and Medicare and LBJ's Great Society, doesn't some of that send the wrong message to our enemies that America cares about domestic issues, not just about foreign policy?
Indirectly, yes. Here's why.
Okay, I can't wait. Can I guess? It's because we never got him to never got to see him standing up, and therefore America doesn't stand up for its principles.
No. FDR gave away Eastern Europe through Yalta. And then the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. The Muslims had to fight back. That's where bin Laden got his start.
But it's worse than just politics, right? I mean, it's worse than just international relations that does it. Isn't our culture itself corrosive and invites this kind of attack?
Well, that's what the radical Muslims say. They say America is the fount of global depravity and atheism.
Do you think that there's any truth to this? That our culture, because I'm with you, our culture is depraved, correct?
Wrong.
Hollywood is depraved.
No, but
Hollywood is depraved or not? You pro-Hollywood or anti-Hollywood?
Well, I might have mixed feelings about Hollywood.
Oh, that's not going to sell books.
But I'll tell you this. We in America know that there's a big difference between some of the excesses of our popular culture and the way that Americans actually live. But abroad, they don't know that. The only America they see is the face of TV and the music industry and the movies. So they're getting a distorted picture of America, but that's the only America they see.
What should we be sending them? Because I'm afraid they're seeing things like, you know, the Goonies. And I'm pretty sure that's responsible for the Cole attack. What about, can't we send them stuff like this? Jimmy, show them the truck source. Isn't this the kind? Wouldn't this send a strong message to our enemies not to mess with us? Wouldn't this be helpful?
Symbolically, it might be useful. But look, here's the point. The point I'm trying to make is that there is an America, a traditional America, and also a liberal America. Very often, the only America that the Muslims see is blue America. They see the America of gay marriage. They see the America of people eating maggots. They see one side of America. They don't
Why
see...
Why do gay people love maggots so much?
I wasn't...
But I've never been to a gay wedding, but I assume it's on the buffet.
I don't know everything about the gay lifestyle,
but... What can we do? Because I am with you that there is this depraved, destructive element in our culture that invites attacks by Islamic extremists. But what can we do to get the attacks straight to them and leave us alone? Because there's certainly real Americans like you and me, and then liberal Americans who don't deserve our protection or our liberties.
Look, I'm not... We can't convince the Islamic radicals.
But you can convince me.
Not you. There are a lot of traditional Muslims mm-hmm. who have traditional values, not very different from traditional Jewish or Christian values.
And can we just hold hands in brotherhood and keep, use our free hands to stone gay people? Is that possible?
No. Look, homosexuality exists all over the world. It's not something that...
But it's our responsibility to stop here, not everywhere in the world.
No, but there's a difference between something that is allowed or tolerated and something that is seen as given social sanction. That's, I think, what makes a lot of traditional Muslims uneasy. Here's all I'm saying. Why don't we show them a little more of the traditional America? That will undermine bin Laden's argument that we're all a bunch of atheists. Mm-hmm. That will undermine bin Laden's idea that America is trying to project.
So what other cultural editing notes should we take from the terrorists?
It's not editing notes. It's just a matter
of... I mean, I agree with you. There are some good ideas these guys have. This is what you're saying. That there are some parts of our culture that are corrosive, and you agree with some of the things that they're saying.
I'm saying that...
You have the courage to say that, right? That you agree with some of the things that these radical extremists are against in America.
I'm more concerned...
Do you agree with that statement?
Well, no, I'm...
Do you agree with that statement?
I agree with it.
Okay, good.
But...
Finally,
but,
someone has the courage
but,
to say that there are things in America that the liberals do that are causing our destruction.
Okay, that's going too far.
That's what you're saying. The cultural left and its responsibility for 9/11. That's why I had you on the show, because I agree with that statement.
But I didn't do 9/11.
No, because you're not cultural left, and cultural left people did do 9/11.
But bin Laden says that he did 9/11 for foreign policy reasons and because he sees America as culturally depraved.
Right, so the cultural left is responsible for 9/11. When do you think bin Laden's going to get a movie deal?
No movie deal for that guy.
He's not truly part of the cultural left. I think you need to do your research a little bit better. Dinesh D'Souza, thank you for stopping by.
Pleasure.
The book is The Enemy at Home. We'll be right back.
So you see how stupid D'Souza really is when he's just challenged a little bit. He has a book called The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and its responsibility for 9/11. So Colbert just flips him around quite easily and basically says that then you in essence are agreeing with your fictitious hypothesis of the bin Ladens, Uncle Bens of the world, attacking Sam and attacking America because of the cultural, quote-unquote, depravity that they see in these Hollywood Pop-Tart-type movies. D'Souza agrees with it. And then Colbert is easily able to pin him down with his alignment then with the bin Laden caricature. Now, we slaves know this is all in make-believe land, because bin Laden, at least when he was alive, was just a cutout of the U.S. military intelligence apparatus and this so-called Al-Qaeda network and all of that. It's just part of an extended black ops false flag operation of U.S. military intelligence. They're running the ship on these issues and stuff. It's not the other way around. And they use this apparatus for their own permanent war agenda. But what shysters like D'Souza, Fox News, it has that similar trend where they're trying to blame elements within the American society. And of course, it's not the elements within the ruling circles for coddling, quote unquote, terrorists, for wanting to cut and run. All of these types of propagandistic type slogans help interweave within the network of how D'Souza himself was trying to frame things. Yet, when he's challenged on that, and how he agrees, within his own words, of how the cultural left and its responsibility for 9/11 is right in accord with the fictitious image created about bin Laden's influence and so-called independent movement. He's forced to back up off of it, showing how shallow his arguments really are. But in this land of make-believe, where they are not usually challenged, they can go on and on like this. So he starts off talking about how what the Islams basically see is an America through Hollywood movies and the music industry. And of course, he's talking about the pop culture version of Hollywood. When in reality, what most people under the boots of Sam see is the machine gun, is actually those cowboy boots of imperial occupation on their lands. They see the body bags of their babies put into coffins courtesy of U.S. white phosphorus and depleted uranium. That's what they see and feel. But these guys are intentionally false flag operators within the book publishing network, the corporate media like Hannity, the Hollywood mechanisms. It's all about propagandizing in a distorted way for imperial purposes. Now, while they blather on and create this great gulf in ideas and so-called agendas, in many ways, since they're all coming from an imperial construct, whether we're talking about the D'Souzas of the world or other nation states that may be in certain types of conflict with Sam, but agree on the oppression and suppression of the masses of the world, and how they want the fight to be fought out is that no matter who wins, the elite privatized rulers are on top. You end up having collaborations which help perpetuate the imperial war agendas by elites throughout the world. In other words, Tuesday, June 12, 2007, Guardian paper. CIA recruits Sudanese to infiltrate Arab jihadi groups. Article goes, quote, the CIA faced with the impossibility of infiltrating white Americans into radical groups in the Middle East is recruiting Arab-speaking Sudanese citizens in spite of sanctions against the country over the killing in Darfur. It emerged yesterday. Sudanese recruits have been providing information about individuals passing through Sudan to Somalia and elsewhere in the Horn of Africa and Iraq. The Sudanese government is reported to have detained suspects in Khartoum at the request of the U.S. The U.S. State Department issued a report describing Sudan as a, quote, strong partner in the war on terror, unquote. Let me stop right there. And as many slave listeners know, I've often gone into and will continue to go into how despite the imperial jousting that you see going on between Sam and China over Sudan, the Khartoum government is not a victim. They're not some poor little victim being picked on by imperial forces or Zionist apparatus. Of course, the Zionists and imperialists of the U.S. have their own agenda. But the reality is that The game that the cartoon government plays is within that same network of imperial expansion, domination, and suppression, because they believe in the privatized order. So, at the end of the day, they're playing the same game with what influence, resources, and military power that they have. They're not a resistance force in it. And those same techniques of destruction that the U.S. is playing inside and outside its borders is the same techniques that the Sudanese Khartoum government, the self-identifying Arab Khartoum government, the NIF, National Islamic Front, play within its own borders. They're all thugs. And they all play genocidal games and Russian roulette forms of destruction on the population. But if you buy into the generic cutouts that you see people play about these various players, you would be lost in one grand illusion. Now, overlaying with this Hollywood book imperial propaganda strategy by the likes of, you know, con men like D'Souza, is the interweaving of propaganda of myths by the state's intelligence apparatus, as outlined by Ralph McGehee, former CIA operative and author of the book Deadly Deceits, 25 years in the CIA. Here's what I mean.
The agency has tremendous relations with the established media. I think somewhere else it goes on to list all of the various organizations, the television news, the magazines, the newspapers, even Hollywood studios has very close relations with all of these organizations, including, of course, academia. And it uses those relationships to color stories to favor the CIA. I say color, it can be from just changing them from one view to another, just changing the slant a bit, or however minimally changing the story. It's been doing that, of course, since it was created in 47. One of the things that I discovered in my career in the agency was that the agency uses its intelligence frequently as a disinformation mechanism for deceiving, I wouldn't say deceiving, but putting forth the correct policy line. If it's involved in creating a war in Vietnam or creating a covert operation in Vietnam, then all of its intelligence lines up to support that war. And in that particular case, not only was the intelligence created to form a fantasy of, essentially a fantasy of what was going on, but the agency had a rather massive domestic operation to draw the United States into the war, and when things started going bad, to keep us in the war.
So once again, you can see how these mechanisms overlap one another. You have Ralph McGee pointed out how the agency uses its intelligence apparatus to put forth the correct, the orthodox line of the imperial policy from Vietnam and beyond. Now, as I've gone into in the slave program American-made wars, American-made myths, Vietnam and Iraq, how these propaganda mechanisms become deeply part of the belief system of the American culture. And it's not just through one mechanism. You have the media fantasy propagandizing things out to draw the or to help codify the justification of the elite's war aims into a particular region. So you'll have the Judith Millers, you know, from the New York Times, these stories of make-believe. You'll have the Niger, Iraq, uranium myths be created. All of these mechanisms will take place, while at the same time, you'll have books being made. And some of them are strategist books. Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard, that helped Project of the New American Century later. PNAC, in the same vein, for global conquest. But in spite of these real, more honest objectives, the Judith Millers of the world, the fantasies in Hollywood, the Dinesh D'Souzas in the book publishing world helped create a fantasy about the others that is devoid of the real aims of the imperialists. In the case of Vietnam, the real spark of what was to come actually got started off in September of 1945, when Vietnam declares its independence from France, and then Sam led an armed invasion of French and Nazi units, rearmed Nazi units, literally, who were put into the French Foreign Legion, and met rearmed Japanese troops who saluted them in Saigon. That was the beginning of the next phase, with Sam's more direct involvement of what was to become the Vietnam War. There was no two Vietnams at that time. But in the world of make-believe, these types of historical facts need to be left out. At the same time, you have movies like Deer Hunter flip the script and have North Vietnamese force U.S. G.I. Joes to put the revolver to their temples and play Russian roulette, when in actuality it was the other way around. It was as that legendary picture captured for the world to see. It was a general, or the General Lone, a fighter for the U.S. imperialists, who ended up executing a resistor of U.S. imperial occupation. But within 3 years of the Vietnam War ending, which ended in 75, Deer Hunter comes out, flips the script, and now many people in America actually believe that that legendary picture is in reverse. That the picture that they saw is that one of a U.S. captured Vietnamese soldier being shot by a North Vietnamese, showing once again the power of the Hollywood mechanism and how it overlaps with the mechanisms of destroying, actually, intelligence in the American landscape. Now, as these things continue to be propagandized out, it helps create a better platform for the lead administrator for the ruling order to make his particular claims as Boy George at the State of the Union. Keeps the imperial jargon right in focus with his stay the course mission, which is really for energy, resource, dollar and change dominance of the planet.
Many in this chamber understand that America must not fail in Iraq. Because you understand that the consequences of failure would be grievous and far-reaching. If American forces step back before Baghdad is secure, the Iraqi government would be overrun by extremists on all sides. We could expect an epic battle between Shia extremists backed by Iran and Sunni extremists aided by Al-Qaeda and supporters of the old regime. A contagion of violence could spill out across the country. And in time, the entire region could be drawn into the conflict. For America, this is a nightmare scenario. For the enemy, this is the objective. Chaos is the greatest ally, their greatest ally in this struggle. And out of chaos in Iraq would emerge an emboldened enemy with new safe havens, new recruits, new resources, and an even greater determination to harm America. To allow this to happen would be to ignore the lessons of September the 11th and invite tragedy. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing is more important at this moment in our history than for America to succeed in the Middle East, to succeed in Iraq, and to spare the American people from this danger.
So now, you can see how and hear how it all ties together. From Patton's speech to Hollywood, to D'Souza's rhetoric, to the role as Ralph McGeehee pointed out about the aspects of the CIA's influence on down the line. To Boy George making his imperial speech based in imperial rhetoric. America must not fail Iraq. The consequences will be great and far-reaching. This is the same type of rhetoric that the propagandists during the Vietnam era were saying, we must not fail Vietnam. There's far-reaching consequences. It would be devastating. There would be no end to this situation if the U.S. were to allow the tide of communist expansion to take place in the theater of Vietnam. All the while, their objectives, of course, are quite the contrary. Now, you hear a boy talk about how you have Shiite extremists backed by Iran, Sunni extremists backed by Al-Qaeda, and also supporters of the old regime. Al-Qaeda, as I've noted many times before, is a component of U.S. intelligence military apparatus. But with all of the propagandizing done through the corporate media, through Hollywood, these types of things are digestible by large portions of the American population. Because, in essence, they see the corporate media as an ally. They see Hollywood as an ally and as simply a mechanism of entertainment. They see writers like D'Souza grind to the nose, grind to the ground, fact finding and writing authors. They don't see them because they're so caught up in the war matrix Hollywood lens of what they really are and what they really represent, which is really dangerous for all humanity. Boy outlined how chaos is there, meaning the quote-unquote terrorists greatest ally. Now just think how often in America the chaos theory of terror is often pushed through in America and its media services. The color codes, the checking at airlines, the Al-Qaeda networks are in your neighborhood and soon coming to a town near you. Meanwhile, the U.S. and the CIA network are torturing and rendering people, which permits a certain amount of chaos. Within their own guidelines, they allow stress positions, sexual abuse, simulated drownings, sensory deprivations. From Abu Ghraib to Area 2 in Chicago, where John Burge has been the lead torture of black inmates for over a 20-year period, when he was a cop. These mechanisms are thoroughly in place. But so inundated and so willing, because of certain relationships and allegiance that much of the American population have, these things are all way too typical. So while boy is defecating out the war for freedom rhetoric, remember, he also stated how Sunni extremists are in alignment with Al-Qaeda and supporters of the old regime. Well, let's check out how in the real world, who else is aligned with some of these Sunni, quote-unquote, extremists?
American forces step back before Baghdad is secured, the Iraqi government would be overrun by extremists on all sides. We could expect an epic battle between Shia extremists backed by Iran and Sunni extremists aided by Al-Qaeda and supporters of the old regime. A contagion of violence could spill out across the country, and in time, the entire region could be drawn into the conflict. And Sunni extremists aided by Al-Qaeda and supporters of the old regime. And Sunni extremists aided by Al-Qaeda and supporters of the old regime.
This is one of America's new allies, the enemy of our enemy, beating a suspected Al-Qaeda member, threatening to kill him. He is part of America's success against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. A member of a Sunni militia group supported by the US to target Al-Qaeda. In this operation north of Baghdad, his group, their uniforms, their faces covered, are working hand in hand with local police and army units, and drawn from insurgent groups and local tribes. These are fighters who've been killing Americans and now use some American-supplied ammunition and US military support to turn on Al-Qaeda. Enemies of the US, now supported by the US.
In Anbar province, Sunni tribes that were once fighting alongside Al-Qaeda against our coalition are now fighting alongside our coalition against Al-Qaeda. We're working to replicate the success in Anbar and other parts of the country.
And this is Anbar. Grainy video posted 2 weeks ago on an Islamist website shows US-aligned militia unloading another Al-Qaeda prisoner from a police pickup. The man in charge asks his prisoner if he killed someone called Khalid. And then, taunting, tells him to say hi to Khalid for me. Cursing their prisoner, the makeshift firing squad leads him to a spot near an embankment. And he's executed. Why would these insurgents and tribesmen turn on Al-Qaeda to work with the Americans? The answer, power, money, contracts, and control over their neighborhoods. And while few mourn the deaths of Al-Qaeda fighters anywhere, summary executions and excessive force by militias sponsored by the US is not something American commanders say they condone nor seek. Brigadier General Mark McDonald.
We don't allow that, and we do not encourage that. We will stop that if we see it.
That said, the general also says he's not seen reports of abuses himself. But another senior U.S. official does say the militia's methods are an ugly side of the war here in Iraq. Ugly, but effective. In the militia-controlled areas, Al-Qaeda has not been defeated, but it's certainly been blunted. The capital of Anbar reclaimed from its grip, and attacks across the province spectacularly reduced, with similar signs emerging in other areas. The successes of the Sunni militias, however, come at a price. The Shia-dominated government in Baghdad is not happy, wary of U.S. support for armed Sunni groups. This support scares us, says Hadi Al-Amri, commanding a powerful Shia militia. He is Iraq's equivalent to the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the U.S. Working with these people is very dangerous, he says. We told the Americans we won't accept under any circumstances their being open to armed Sunni militia like the Islamic Army of Iraq or the brigades of the 1920 revolution. Two of the very groups the US has been courting and supporting. And this former national security minister, now heading a parliamentary oversight body, claims the US is overstepping its authority. That these tribes are armed beyond the government's control might lead to conflict, he says, suggesting they may be an American counterbalance to a government accused of links to Iranian-backed militia from the Shia community.
There's nothing that the multinational force, the Corps, is doing with, by name, by numbers, by place, by location, by intent, that we don't share with the government of Iraq.
With few signs of progress from the central government, America's former insurgent enemies seem to have given US commanders something the Iraqi government rarely has, a success story.
Now this shows how sick this whole game really is. But the responsibility really comes on us to understand this. This enemy of our enemy is somehow our quote-unquote, meaning the imperialist friend. They're just tools. This is part of a military intelligence black op false flag operation for war expansion. Members of the Sunni militia, as he stated, are now working with Sam to defeat Al-Qaeda. Well, in reality, this is propaganda too, because this is basically an expansion of war chaos. This Sunni network is basically designed to deteriorate the Iraqi people's morale and balkanize in these types of tribal hocus-pocus sects more of the Iraqi people into hardened lines, so that the masses of the Iraqi people in this ongoing permanent war situation will become exhausted, and Iraq will be more easily and readily broken up into at least three pieces: Sunni Iraq, Shiite Iraq, Kurdistan Iraq. So this is all part of a transported Salvadorian solution. But the way that the corporate media is trying to spin it is that Sam is just trying to do the right thing, and one has to make hard decisions and hard alignments when one is when in reality the empire has no one's interests but their own. This little Sunni militia is basically helping outsource the terrorism and the interest of the terror state of the U.S. empire. Just like Nike outsources its sweatshops. Now, one of the easily penetratable weaknesses within some of these types of balkanizing groups is that when they base themselves around these particular like hocus pocus identities, it doesn't conflict necessarily with imperialist agendas, because you can be an imperialist and be a capitalist or an imperialist or a colonialist. There's no contradiction in that. So they're after mere power, and they are easily used as false flag operatives whenever need be by the imperial state. Yet, they will not be described within those terms through the war media complex or these war publishing book complexes that Dinesh D'Souza is connected with, or the war Hollywood complex, or, of course, what you heard defecated out of behind of Boy George. Now, you heard the rhetoric by one of the soldiers saying that we don't allow or encourage, torture or any types of brutality and stuff like that. Yet at the same time, Sam is doing that in rendering people itself for just those purposes and has its own redefinition of torture in this permanent war theater. Now, you remember when the war first started, you had one politician and raggedy public commentator after another decrying how the forces that were resisting and fighting against U.S. imperial occupation, how they weren't fighting the fight, quote-unquote, right. In other words, they didn't wear uniforms and stuff like that. Now, here, they openly talk about how this apparatus of U.S. military operational war intelligence, as this Sunni militia basically is, doesn't wear uniforms and have their face covered and all of that. But hey, they're within and being used within the right mechanisms of the U.S. imperial order. So you just ignore that. And when or if these situations culminate into the chaotic, destructive, life-draining goals that the U.S. has, then this little fake Iraqi government will be easily disposed of and discarded. Just like their one-time friends, Saddam, Noriega, Mobutu, have been. And when you think of TV shows like 24, where this Jack Clown, episode after episode, often uses terrorism in the form of torture to achieve his particular goals of getting so-called information, and how this has actually influenced a lot of actual military people who have recruits who all want to be like Jack, you know, and have these fantasies of how these mechanisms work and don't even understand the whole agenda of why these techniques are actually being used, because they themselves, as little G.I. Joes and Janes, are caught up in the Matrix itself, shows how otherworldly this whole thing is. But within these images that are being portrayed, here you have forces that just like the script we just heard coming out over the corporate media networks about the Sunni alliance with SAM and how that is supposed to play a particular way and play out a particular way, here you have another script being played out by the forces that be in this imperial network.
Often, the special assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Entertainment Media will receive a script concurrently with my office. I'll do a sort of peripheral read where I just kind of get the main points and see where does it have the Army. And that's the first thing I look for, is the first specific Army or military mention. And I'll sort of make notes of it. We're here. The second time I'll go through and read it with a bit more critical eye. How would that soldier really behave in that situation? What sort of language is this soldier using? How is the soldier viewed by the civilians in the picture? What is the mood of the piece? And I go by it step by step until I can get through it, and it'll be a script similar to this one that's full of notes,
first of all, when we look at scripts, you know, are we conducting damage control? And the answer is absolutely. It's not my role here to vilify the armed forces, because I'm a believer of the armed forces. I wouldn't be in this job if I didn't. And my colleagues feel the same way. Those who are in the military obviously are adherents. Otherwise, they would vote with their feet and quit. So we are all very much of the opinion that the military is an institution for the betterment of the United States. So any picture that's contrary to that fundamental premise is going to be a problem for us.
So once again, as we see and go back to how this ties together with how the whole Secretary of Defense and Entertainment Media Network is tied within the mechanisms of the state, and how they come up with a particular script, when they see these scripts of how would the soldier really behave, the mood of the piece, etc., etc. Now, when you have facts on the ground, like the Abu Ghraib incident or the Tiger Force during the Vietnam era, where for 7 months, psychotic soldiers went on a rampage against Vietnamese citizens, shooting, burning, destroying unarmed Vietnamese peasantry's lives. Now, in the world of Hollywood, this would not fit the proper script of how a soldier, quote-unquote, really behaves. But in the real world, that is how they behaved. Abu Ghraib existed. The use of white phosphorus existed. So when you hear this clown talk about how he's a believer of armed forces and the military and the institution for the betterment of the United States, basically, that's just pro-militarism, pro-imperialism. It's not based off of the facts of how the reality on the ground really is. It's based off of the alliance and relationship that he has with the state through its armed force networks, and how from that vantage point, he is going to try to give a pro-militarized imperial spin, which helps further the cause of empire and destruction of humanity. This individual is a fraud. He's a louse. As he himself noted, any picture that challenges U.S. military role as a force for the good, he has a problem with. Well, that quite naturally is just him looking through the world through the imperialist worldview within a militarized and U.S. military component, which further justifies the ruler's agenda. Which is why you can't really separate the boots on the ground from the policies and the interests of the elite within a given society. He's just, as he said, a damage control specialist. But the damage is basically to nullify the reality that's here on Earth and to spin it up into a Hollywood version of an illusion of how the imperialist war and in whose interest is really engaged in. So with this mind driven within the order's Matrixian vortex madness set up in place, it's clear to see how a buffoon like a Bill O'Reilly is able to conduct himself in an interview in a society like this, when he basically engages in a conversation with a 29-year Army vet, Colonel Ann Wright, over the detained British soldiers who were in Iranian waters a while back, and how that played itself out and how it should, at least to those of the Bill O'Reilly's worldview, should have played itself out.
What should be done to Iran for abusing the captured Brits? Joining us now from Portland, Oregon, Colonel Ann Wright, who taught the Geneva Conventions to troops at Fort Bragg. Colonel Wright spent 29 years in the Army before retiring. But according to the UN, this is a violation of the Geneva Conventions, holding these people, and it's an unprovoked act of aggression. Do you agree?
Well, I think we have to be very careful, and I think that it's the jury is still out on exactly where the ships were and all, whether it was Iraqi waters, Iranian
waters. But that'll never be proven, Matt. I mean, you know that.
The main thing is not to let this be ratcheted up, that the Iranians and the British government need to be very, very careful on how they handle this so that it won't escalate further, because certainly the danger flashpoints in that section of the world are tremendous right now.
But you didn't answer my question, so I'll pose it again. The UN says that this was a violation of the Geneva Conventions, which you taught, and they say this was an unprovoked act of aggression by Iran. Do you concur, madam?
Well, I concur that all people that are detained by any power must be treated appropriately. And if you look at the Geneva Conventions, which is prisoners of war, and right now there's no state of war between Iran and Great Britain, but taking the high ground, the moral high ground, the Iranians should be treating the British with the utmost of care. They should not subject them to public curiosity.
But they are.
And by showing photos, just as the Americans have done in other cases, which was wrong. I mean, we lose the moral high ground when we do conduct.
So this is our fault? This Iranian seizure is our fault?
No, not at all.
I want to stop the interview right here, Colonel. I just want you to be aware of how you're coming across. I've asked you very specific questions, which you generalize answer. You then threw it back into the Americans' court for no reason. America isn't in play here. You just threw it back and took a slap at your own country, madam. All right, so
people that are watching here who need to be very well aware that we have some very, very difficult situations going on in the Middle East, where the United States has almost an armada across the whole Persian Gulf.
That's what I thought you were going to say. This is our fault. Because, we're there.
That's going on there. And any escalation, when there are acts of, well, who knows what the provocations are. The whole world needs to be very, very careful, and we appeal to the Iranians to treat the people that they have
detained. Yeah, but they're obviously they're not doing what you want. They're laughing at your appeal.
I want to get you on the record. The United States need to be treating people in Afghanistan and Guantanamo according to
international law. So it's our fault. This whole thing is our fault, right? It's our fault. I'm agreeing with you. We're the evil people in the world. Because that's what you're putting out there. And you put it out consistently, man.
We are having
very
difficult times in our own determination of what is right and what is wrong. And I think the Bush administration has picked a very different route from what the Geneva Conventions have been.
We wanted to talk about the Iranian hostage situation.
That we actually abide by what the true Geneva Conventions are, that you treat people appropriately, that you don't subject them to public curiosity, that you don't intimidate, you don't humiliate them.
That's what they're doing in Iran right now. But I just want to get it. I want to recap. We wanted to talk to you about the Iranian illegal seizure of these military people and the abuse of them. You, Colonel, turn the conversation around to slap at your own country, to diminish the Bush administration, and to bring in all these other things, and you haven't criticized Iran once.
The Bush administration has been violating international law and Geneva Conventions. Tragically, the U.S. Congress went along with some of it through this Military Commissions Act.
I'm glad you came on, Colonel.
Alternative alternative interrogation techniques.
I love the fact that you're here.
Because I do want to make sure the Iranians treat people properly, and I want to make sure the United States treat people properly.
Sure you do.
I surely do. That's what I spent 29 years of my life trying to do.
You know what happened to you? Somewhere along the line.
Very important.
All right. Somewhere along the line.
I spent 29 years. How many did you serve? Where did you teach the Geneva Convention?
Cut her mic off. Goodbye. All right.
Yeah, I'm glad you came on. I wanted you to see her. Not about Iran, not about their seizure or treatment of the Brits. We're there. And she's not alone. That's what you have. Next on the rundown, Tony.
Now this passes as a media, acceptable media. In a country where you have basically a buffoon who has the audacity to ignore the numerous people who have been illegally detained within this country and outside of these borders, where its intelligence apparatus is running around the planet kidnapping people and then rendering them off illegally against international law to places where they're often disappeared. Yet, this is all to be pushed aside and ignored. And then, when someone brings up issues about not blowing this out of proportion, i.e. hyping it up for a justification for more war expansion, which is what this is in part really about, then this person is attacked, and then the coward has her mic cut off, and you see her lips moving on the screen, but you can't hear her because of what O'Reilly had done. And any challenges that go outside of the particular script in this little Fox broadcast is basically discarded and rewritten away in the same way that the script writers or the script overseers that we heard for the military who review Hollywood scripts, review issues, comments, portrayals of the U.S. military in these Hollywood movies, and if those go outside the guidelines, they too are discarded and whited out. Meanwhile, the mechanism of destruction and corporatization continue on as you have Boeing subsidiaries being accused of profit of torture, as you have extraordinary renditioning being done by Boeing subsidiary who allow their planes to be used by the CIA apparatus that is kidnapping people. And as many of these clowns in the Democrat and Republican Party are babbling out how when U.S. G.I. Joes are supposed to quote-unquote leave Iraq, a major Baghdad embassy plans ended up being turned up online as, quote, detailed plans for the new U.S. embassy under construction in Baghdad appeared online Thursday in a breach of the tight security surrounding the sensitive sub-project. Computer-generated projections of the soon-to-be-completed heavily fortified compound were posted on the website of the Kansas City, which is a base architectural firm that was contracted to design the massive facility in the Iraqi capital. The images were removed by Berger Devine Yeager shortly after the company was contacted by the State Department. Quote, We worked very hard to ensure the safety and security of our employees overseas, unquote, said Gonzalo Gallegos, a department spokesman. Quote, this kind of information out in the public domain detracts from our efforts, unquote. The 10 images included a scheme of an overall layout of the compound, plus depictions of individual buildings including the embassy itself, office annexes, the military corporate security post, swimming pool, recreational center, and the ambassador's and deputy ambassador's residence. The U.S. official said the posted plans conform at least roughly to conceptual drawings for the new embassy, which is being built on the banks of the Tigris River, behind huge fences due to concerns about insurgents' attacks. In other words, the U.S. empire, once again, has no plans of going anywhere. From its G.I. Joe soldiers to its killers for hire in a world for sale mercenaries, to big oil, to the disaster capitalists like Halliburton, to the arms capitalists who still plan on to continue to sell their arms of death to keep making their profit while Iraqis keep on dying. This is the way the game is truly played. And when other regions around Iraq see the writing somewhat on the wall and try to make compromises themselves, well, unfortunately for them, the script has already been written, as Sam has other plans throughout the region. Hold on a sec.
Well, this is back in May 2003. The United States had just defeated Saddam in less than 3 weeks. And I think there were a lot of feelings in Tehran that they needed to present some sort of a negotiation deal with the United States. But what they presented was quite similar to many things that they have communicated verbally to the United States over the last couple of years. Basically, they said the United States has a couple of aims, Iran has a couple of aims, and there's a process to be able to proceed with the negotiations. And what the Iranians agreed to discuss as a framework of the negotiations was how to disarm the Hezbollah, how to end support to Hamas and Islamic Jihad, how to open up the nuclear program, how to help the United States stabilize Iraq and ensure that the government there would be not along sectarian lines, and also how to sign on to the Beirut Declaration, which is basically a formal recognition of the two-state solution. These are far-reaching compromises that Iran potentially would have agreed to in the negotiations, but the Bush administration decided simply not to respond to the proposal. The United States, back in 1991, established the Swiss embassy in Iran as a go-between between the United States and Iran. The U.S. needed a channel of communication, a reliable channel of communication between the two countries, just to ensure that the war in Iraq back in 1991 would not cause any misunderstandings between Iran and the United States that could be dangerous. That channel was then afterwards in existence, and the Swiss ambassador to Iran is a person that usually visits the U.S. every 6 months and gives a report to the United States, to State Department, sometimes to Congress, about what the situation in Iran is, mindful of the fact that the U.S. itself does not have any diplomats in Iran. So this channel has been used on numerous occasions by the United States and by Iran to be able to send messages to each other. And this time around, the Iranians gave a proposal to the Swiss ambassador that he then sent to the Swiss foreign ministry in Bern, who faxed it on to the State Department. But the Swiss ambassador also made a personal visit to Washington, D.C. to brief the State Department about the proposal, and he also made sure that he met with Congressman Ney, who had been a long-time advocate for negotiations and dialogue between the United States and Iran, and he handed him the proposal as well. Advisor to Bob May at the time, and Tim met with Bob and handed over the proposal to him, and Bob afterwards sent it to be hand-delivered to the White House to Karl Rove, and Karl Rove called back within 2 hours, and they had a brief discussion about the proposal. Basically said that it was an intriguing proposal. He first wanted to know if it was authentic, and the congressman assured him that it was, according to what the Swiss ambassador had said. And you have to remember, the Swiss ambassador would not be handing over proposals to the United States unless they were authentic. The Swiss ambassador's work has been requested by the U.S., not by the Iranians. So he's basically fulfilling a mission that has been given to him by the United States.
So in other words, the regime of Tehran contacted the U.S. Empire shortly after Sam penetrated into Iraq in this current war and proposed all types of compromises, basically to save their own hide. But Sam had other agendas. And one of the compromises they were willing to work on, amongst all other things of betrayal against Palestinians and everything else, was the issue of the nuclear facilities. But Sam kicked it to the curb, because this is not about working things out. This is about them achieving their objectives. And those objectives are planned to be achieved through blood and fire. It's time to look beyond the Pentagon, Hollywood, corporate media, military industrial market complex estate lenses and check out the world for and through the interest of the slaves. Until the next time. Slave out.